Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine that does a whole hell of a lot better on those occasions when we testify in front of Congress. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Good morning, free speechers.
Howdy.
Hello, Matt.
Happy Monday.
That's right. Before we get started, I just wanted to say thank you to all of you wonderful people in Roundtabledom for helping make this year's annual fundraising webathon an all-timer. Raised more dollar bills than we ever have in our 16-year history of doing this, more than $700,000. And many of you in the little comments fields said very nice things about the roundtable, or at least made fun of Nick. So either way, that's a win-win.
Well, we can finally get that DEI initiative off the ground now, Matt.
Oh, God. Flashbacks to text messages from my daughter's school. Anyways, thank you for helping make this stuff work and for making new, exciting Reason branded products lift off the ground and start shooting towards the moon. Speaking of which, Catherine, are there any new Reason branded editorial products that you would like to hype to our listeners as a way of thanking them for their contributions to the webathon?
I would love to do that. Thank you, Matt. One thing that is new this last week is Rent Free, a newsletter from Christian Bridgekey about why zoning and housing and urban policy is so messed up and maybe how to fix it. The word YIMBY will be used a lot in this newsletter. And if that sounds good to you, you should sign up for it. It's called Rent Free, as in Christian Bridgekey lives rent free in your head. And you should sign up for it. And also our slowly evolving but now officially launched YouTube show Just Asking Questions, starring Liz Wolf and Zach Weissmuller, will be on your YouTubes every week, and they're going to have a guest and they're going to just ask some questions. So that's just a couple of the things that your webathon money will buy. Stay tuned for more.
Thank you, Catherine. I think, Nick, that we should have long ago instituted the pronunciation of Weissmuller.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of I'm chopped up that we didn't do that. Excuse me, I'm going to clear my throat.
That one really hits you, doesn't it, Matt?
It does. It does. All right. It was arguably the worst day for academic leadership since the Faber College homecoming parade. The heads of Harvard, MIT, and Penn were hauled up on Capitol Hill last Tuesday and soon found themselves outsmarted by Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who couldn't get a basic human answer to the question of, does calling for genocide against Jews violate your campus policy? That hearing and much public froth about academia besides was a byproduct of campus tumult in the wake of the October 7th massacre and mass kidnapping by Hamas terrorists just over the border in Israel. In the 6 days since that testimony, all kinds of crazy stuff has happened. Penn President Liz McGill resigned. Harvard President Claudine Gay has faced calls to step down. I think they're having an emergency meeting or some kind of big meeting just today on Monday as we're recording this. Now, there have been some credible sounding, worrying sounding accusations of plagiarism about her past work. The University of Wisconsin Board of Regents has narrowly rejected a deal with Republican lawmakers that would have traded some long-delayed campus pay raises for gutting the university's diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's DEI, bureaucracy. New York Governor Kathy Hochul has threatened to block state and federal funding for the Empire State's colleges and universities that allow calls for genocide to take place. I'm sure there's going to be no problems with the enforcement mechanism of that. The media is full of formulations like conservatives seize the moment. Many of the backpedaling faculty.
They definitely are pouncing.
It's a seize pounce.
Seize pounce. I think you have to do that in Pilates.
There's a lot of different calls for now expanding campus anti-harassment policies to include some pro-Palestinian slogans. The alternative centristy media universe is filled in turn with calls for ending rather than mending DEI and all the identity politics infrastructure besides. And also, Saturday Night Live had its worst cold open since the last time you paid attention to a Saturday Night Live cold open, with the possible exception of the post 2016 election weepy version of Hallelujah. Yeah. That's unintentionally great.
Yeah.
Anyways, Catherine, it's a big mess is what I'm trying to say at the opening here. And there's like 75 different things that we or angles that we have talked about on this show in various times over the years. So I'd like to kind of narrow it down, if you will, to kind of our overriding, I want to think, a concern here, which is about free speech. Has it been a good week for free speech? Has it been a bad week for free speech? Or has it just been a good week to see how bad free speech has gotten?
The latter. Thank you. So I think the problem is that we are just now seeing the next phase of the weaponization of the free speech discourse, right? So we had a bunch of people who were, you know, pretty plausibly and semi-consistently saying like, hey, it seems like all this whole cluster of stuff, this like safe spaces and DEI and protected classes and, you know, canceling the professors for making people read classic texts that had bad things in them, like all that stuff. People were like, that's not what colleges are for. Colleges are for saying things out loud and exploring ideas and thinking through stuff. And you need a kind of ethos of free speech, a culture of free speech in which to do that. Then that same group of people, when the speech that they didn't like suddenly became more prominent, we're like, oh, but not like that much free speech. Like, oh, no, not those words. I obviously am horrified that like it's a cool thing on campuses now to casually call for the genocide of anyone. That's not ideal. Don't love that. But I also really, really, really think that if we take this to its kind of conclusion and say, yeah, it's fine to, you know, it's fine to have free speech for all these other things, but this is a bridge too far. And for this speech, we're revoking funding. We're revoking visas for foreign students. We're creating all of these sanctions by law on this subtype of speech. That's going to end badly. It always ends badly. You cannot have politicians making rules about which speech is allowed, especially on college campuses, where you should have maximal latitude for speech, even really, really gross speech that calls for genocide.
I know a lot of people, Nick, get frustrated by that libertarian take, the classical liberal take, which is like, yeah, sure, they're calling for genocides. They're harassing Jewish students and kind of pounding on the library doors in New York. And now you're just retreating to your, well, there should be more free speech, not less. And meanwhile, you're kind of turning a blind eye towards the real problem of that. What is a way to take our position here and kind of use it proactively to create a better free speech climate now? Not just to say, yes, free speech should also cover this odious stuff over here, but like the new converts to free speech this week as they're wiggling desperately trying to save their job. What should they do, or the people at the university who's funding, what should they do to help right now turn that into actual action, either going forward or even going backward?
You know, I think the first thing, and this was on, you know, kind of brilliant display when Elise Stefanik, who is really, despite a Harvard pedigree, is one of the most fundamentally stupid people in a stupid legislative body called, you know, Congress, House of Representatives, a believer in the Great Replacement Theory, which is anti-Semitic at its core, nonetheless tripped up, you know, three, you know, high-level presidents because they would not speak the truth. They, you know, because what she was asking is, does, you know, chants of, you know, Intifada and From the River to the Sea, should that be covered under the harassment policies that you have in place? Because these schools don't have free speech. They have very strident, harassment policies. And a couple of weeks ago, you know, they were talking about microaggressions or people, you know, you could get in trouble if you ask somebody how to pronounce their name or, you know, what language did you grow up speaking, things like that. And then you have mass demonstrations where students are shouting slogans that are associated with, they're not necessarily identical with calls for genocide, and they're not incitements to immediate danger or anything like that. But it's clear those types of rallies if they were directed towards Black students, if they were directed toward Palestinian students, et cetera. Like, they would be shut down immediately. And these fucking college presidents were so cowardly or over-lawyered or something where they were just lying. And everybody knew they were lying. Like, they could not, you know, come to the table with any clarity to say, you know, this is our policy and this is how we push it in all cases and in all directions. What I hope to get to your question, Matt, is that the new people or the people who believe in free speech will recognize that it means you have to pick two courses, okay? And one of them is much better than the other. One is either that if you have a harassment policy, you know, such as these are all private universities and they all can, you know, tell the First Amendment to go screw, then you have to enforce those policies, you know, equally across the board, regardless of the content or the group that is being attacked. Or seeing that and the fact that you're not going to do that, you're not going to do that equally to all groups that are being attacked, get rid of those and then really have a free speech ethos where you are constantly making sure that there are not imminent threats, incitement to danger, anything like that, fighting words, and then you let it rip and you come back to things. This is the problem, is that universities want to say, oh, we are the bastions of free speech and we're, you know, the place outside of the marketplace. We have the freedom to do this kind of thought work, blah, blah, blah. But they're not. They want to control speech and they want to control it for particular reasons. And when they get called out on that, even by, you know, dumb people like Elise Stefanik, they look like complete jackasses because they have no convictions that they're willing to follow through.
Van Jones in a CNN or even in speech, but Van Jones of CNN had a little a quip that Fareed Zakaria played on a segment he did over the weekend in which he said college campuses should be safe places for unsafe ideas, which seems pretty.
I honestly thought you were going to say college campuses should be safe, legal, and rare.
They're getting
also
there.
Believe
they're
that.
Getting
there.
I think that's
they're
right.
Getting there. Well, as part of that, Peter, in Fareed Zakaria's thing, which got a lot of play over the weekend, basically said that one-sided university politics combined with a sort of one-sided interest in politics, which is pretty new, that interest side just over the past 20 years, by the universities in question has been by now proven kind of to be repellent. Measurably, like people's interest in college, their respect for colleges have started to nosedive there. What say you to that analysis and also to the prescription from the Zakarias of the world of like, stop doing the politics?
I think that's basically right. And it's not just Zakaria. There's also a sort of, I don't know if it quite rises to the level of like a clear plan, but a Twitter outlined or X.com outlined proposal from Steven Pinker, who basically says that, who's at Harvard, by the way, and he basically says that campuses should enact clear and coherent free speech policies. They should try to be institutionally neutral about public controversies, which is to say they should not weigh in on every stupid thing. They should just stop that right now. And then they should also make sure that there are no heckler's vetoes, that you don't shout down people because everyone has the right to free speech and your right to free speech does not extend to stopping other people's free speech. So there's that summary there comes in part from what I think is one of the better columns I have seen on all of this. A sort of comprehensive overviews comes from David French in the New York Times, who just starts his column with, I think, the clearest and most succinct encapsulation of the problem here, which is that censorship put these presidents in their predicament, and censorship will not help them escape. And you have to stop doing it. And you just end like, you know, there's that article that you mentioned, Matt, also in the New York Times by Nick Confessori, I think, you know, the conservatives seize on, conservatives pounce. I'm just going to read you one sentence from that article. All three institutions have in recent years punished or censored speech or conduct that drew anger from the left. And everybody can see that there is a clear double standard here and that these people are incredible, ridiculous, weak, cowardly hypocrites. And that makes people mad. people don't like that. And so you need to have a very consistent policy. And that policy needs to be, we're going to have real free speech norms that are predicated on the ideas of the First Amendment.
Even though, to be clear,
Harvard, MIT, all these are not schools that are bound legally by the First Amendment, but that is the guide, and that should be the guide. And that should be the thing that they are trying to enforce. And that should be the way that they go about doing the business of free speech and academic inquiry.
Just in general, I think it's also really worth being clear. The problem isn't the hypocrisy. The problem is the bad policies. Hypocrisy is what is making people mad right now, but it's just the straight up underlying terrible pre-existing policies that put them in this place, and those are what needs to be repaired. I think there's a tremendous temptation to remedy the hypocrisy by doing the bad policies and applying them equally to both sides. That is not the right solution.
I totally agree with that. But, you know, Matt's question was, is the hypocrisy that is visibly on display turning people against colleges? I think the answer is yes, very much. I also think the hypocrisy is the hypocrisy is revealing how bad these policies have been. And so the hypocrisy is not itself the problem, but it is the way that a lot of people are finally able to see that this is a big and real problem. And you have folks like Sam Altman, just for example, the head of OpenAI, probably the most important AI firm in the country right now, who tweeted within the last week, you know, I used to think that there wasn't a big problem with anti-Semitism on college campuses. I want to say something unequivocally that I was totally wrong about that. That is a summary, not a direct quote, but that is basically the text of his tweet. And I think a lot of folks, he's a big Democratic donor, by the way. And so I think a lot of folks who think of themselves as being on the side of Democrats and on the left and, you know, sort of just on the side of we believe in science and we're pro-academia and we think that's where, you know, knowledge comes from. They are seeing that there are deep institutional problems at these institutions of higher learning.
So is he calling for free speech, for more river to the sea demonstrations, because that's free speech?
That's the beauty of doing a tweet about this. That's what he said.
No, I mean, to go to Steven Pinker's point, and I like and respect Steve Pinker quite a bit, but I think it ultimately is a unreachable aspiration to say that colleges are going to be completely independent of any kind of political issues and things like that. They're not going to be. And even with Harvard, the first problem wasn't what Harvard, the university, the corporation Harvard did. It was a bunch of student groups that issued an insane kind of declaration that Israel was completely and utterly responsible for the slaughter of its own people by Hamas. So it's once you get into this free speech type of thing and you say, let anything go, it sounds great. And then in almost every instance, there are so many different powerful groups, first and foremost with the faculty at universities that have strong opinions about all sorts of stuff and are going to speak up. In a way that makes the idea that, okay, you know what, the university is going to be completely neutral on all of these complicated, controversial topics, including, I don't know, maybe the Defense Department funding massive parts of academia. Should that be critiqued from within the university or not or whatever? I mean, it's the universities are always political entities. And they're going to have to, you know, live and die by the decisions that they make. And it's easy to say we're going to be neutral, but that neutrality, I think, is almost always false.
It's interesting to note that the free speech movement in Berkeley that started bubbling up in the early 1960s was at its root an attempt by students to say, we want to be able to express our political opinions and pass out literature on campus about controversial subjects. The University of California back in the day, under Clark Kerr and some other people, were like, stop with your anti-Vietnam War agitation and anti-Defense Department agitation on campus, because the university should be a place that focuses on learning and ideas and shouldn't get its stuff all mixed up in politics. And students said, said, and they were correct, that you're blocking my free speech, bro. It's kind of interesting to watch the long development, the long march through the institutions where that after, especially, you know, post first Iraq war, but then, you know, George Floyd more than anything else, maybe, or just last 10 years, that has morphed into that universities shall have positions and make statements on all kinds of things. So, yeah, it's a little bit difficult to get into some kind of like new neutrality. But Catherine, I want to pick a bone with you on the hypocrisy thing. Isn't hypocrisy actually part of a problem, which is that if you have some allegedly neutral institution, not neutral, just, you know, allegedly it's open for everybody in that sense of neutrality, institution that claims some elite status to be overwhelmingly on one side of a whole bunch of issues, to cloak itself into academic certainty and all this, to have those places be laughably asymmetrical in the way that they approach speech issues and policy issues, it becomes kind of an issue with that it erodes trust in all these institutions, right? Like the hypocrisy in this case is a mass discrediting tool that discredits not only the universities, but the whole concept of kind of elite guardianship of institutions. And that is something that we deal with, even those of us who try really hard to never dip a toe on evil college campuses.
Yeah, I mean, I think the horrific imbalance in terms of the ideological and political convictions of people who are powerful on these campuses, and therefore downstream from that of the students themselves, is a problem. I actually think that it's almost a separate problem from this specific thing. Like, of course, it's all related, but the, you know, this has been something as long as I have been aware, as long as I have been like reading articles about education, about higher education, this has been a hobby horse, right? Like the right has been mad for decades that there are no right wingers on campus, and they are correct. Like that, those numbers are shocking. I mean, David Horowitz back in the day used to publish those reports that were like, we called every single professor on, you know, the campus of Bates, and we found one moderate Republican, like
in the economics department.
It's always in the economics part, and like be mad about it. And it was, you know, it was a tired shtick even by the time I became aware of it. Doesn't make it less true. Doesn't make it less of a problem. I think that this specific thing that we are witnessing right now, which is the people shouldn't feel sad and be offended and maybe feel scared on their campus, unless those people are Jews, in which case it's fine or something. Like that specific problem, I think is it doesn't map straight onto ideological lines. And, you know, it is increasingly being forced into our standard left-right ideological categories, but only because people want to make hay out of it, I think. So, yes, I mean, it's definitely bad that college campuses are wildly unbalanced. There is a long, long, long-standing issue that has created all kinds of weird distortions on campuses, and this is one of them. But I just, again, think the hypocrisy is a distraction, and that if we want to address the ideological imbalances, we should do that. If we want to address the free speech, the underlying free speech policies, we should do that. But I just think to emphasize the hypocrisy is to tempt fate, to offer to people who have historically been at least rhetorical defenders of free speech the opportunity to let go of that principle in favor of power politics. The American right has shown itself totally willing to do that on every other front in the last many years. And so I am afraid, I predict, in fact, that is what will happen on campuses.
You mean
as well.
We're going to get DEIAG, diversity, equity, inclusion, and anti-genocide?
I mean, I don't know what we're going to get, but it's going to be more rules, not fewer rules. And I think that is the real danger.
You know, Matt, one of the benefits of that spectacle with Congresswoman Stefanik and the three presidents of Harvard, MIT, and Penn was that it all of that, including the fact that Stefanik went to Harvard, it's like, let's evacuate these institutions. These are supposed to be among the very best colleges in the country, et cetera. One of their graduates is an idiot who was shaking and was actually very slippery in her questions.
I'm right because, here, Nick.
Yeah, you're not Harvard, MIT, or Penn, right?
Harvard adjacent.
Okay. So, but it's like the three presidents were terrible. The interlocutor was terrible. Maybe it's time to say those aren't the best places if you are a young mind searching for knowledge. If you are
they're
a
not sending us their
member.
Best.
They're not sending us. I mean, this is where
this stuff is worst. So why not look somewhere else? There's, you know, there's 4,000 colleges and universities. There's about 400 that have any kind of criteria to get into selection. So let's say there's 400 selective universities. Start ranging around wider. And, you know, figure out where you can find a place where there's actually a hospitable intellectual climate and an institutional climate. Or maybe Harvard needs to get better students because the people who signed that, you know, giant document by 23 or 30 groups or whatever right after October 7th, those people are idiots. I don't know that, like, if I was smart, I don't think I'd want to hang out with people like that. And if I was sending my kid to a school, I would rather they go to a place that showed some critical functioning. So
I just think, but I think the extent to which there is a market mechanism or a quasi-market mechanism anywhere in the system, like, though there's already been a reaction there, right? I mean, of course, we have seen these, like, very prominent major donors say, I'm not, you know, $100 million were coming your way and now they're not. Again, this is nothing new. Like when I arrived on campus, the Bass Grant scandal at Yale was underway, which was about funding classical
Western
education,
culture
kind of Western
classes,
canon
right?
type stuff, and had been diverted to fund like whatever the African American Studies program. I can't remember the details. But like donor activism is the place that I think has some potential for change. And, you know, a lot of people in, you know, my age are like, I would never give money to my college. Like that would be bonkers, both because maybe these colleges already have a lot of money, but also because I don't approve of what they're doing. And their business model does, everyone except the very, very, very elite schools, their business model does rely on that churn. It does rely on alumni donations, at least to some extent. So I think if there's a check anywhere in the system, frankly, it's not stupid congressional hearings, and it's not us, it's just dollars.
Well, if those donors revoke their money, there won't be any checks in the system coming their way. No, so to wrap this up just really briefly, I actually think you can tie all of this up together. Catherine's hypocrisy point, Nick's wait, it's not really free speech because there's always institutional interests and political bias and market mechanisms, and we need to sort of find, we need to just find other places for people to go and learn and build knowledge. And I think all of this comes together in moments like this to create a situation in which parents and ambitious kids, applicants to top-tier colleges, are going to be able to look at Harvard and look at Penn and see that these places are run by people who are not serious people and that the institutions themselves are in many ways not serious institutions. Yes, there are very good scholars at all of these institutions. Of course there are. And they do produce a lot of really valuable and worthwhile knowledge. But in many ways, the leadership and the structure of these institutions is unserious, and that if you are an ambitious person who wants to do something big and important in the world, maybe that's not the right place for you. And I think we are seeing just a little bit of that, not a huge amount, but just a little bit of that already with things like the University of Austin, with things like the Peter Thiel program, I just feel like in the past 5 years in particular, there has been this breaking point where a small but ever larger number of interesting, ambitious people at the margins are saying, maybe I don't need an Ivy League degree. Maybe I can just go start something and build something or participate in something that somebody else is starting and building. And that, as much or maybe even more than the dollars from donors, is going to draw people away from higher education. from these elite institutions, or at least traditional higher education, and create new institutions. And that is going to be a process that is going to take a very long time. It's not going to happen over a year or two or five, but over 20 years, if this continues, the hypocrisy means that people are going to be mad and they're not going to want to participate in that. And free speech and institutional neutrality means that the colleges will reveal themselves and show what it is they actually believe. And then people will see and make their choices, and smart, ambitious people will maybe think, you know what? I'd rather just go build my own thing. I don't want to do Harvard. I don't want to do MIT. Sorry, Catherine. Don't even want to do Yale.
All right. Good talk. We're going to go to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first,
hey, folks, this is Spike Cohen, and I'm inviting you to join me next year in Washington, D.C. for LibertyCon. This flagship event by Students for Liberty is being hosted in D.C. the weekend of February the 2nd through the 4th at the Grand Hyatt. Join me and speakers and students from over 30 different countries in one place as we discuss the libertarian solutions that will shape our world and lead us to a freer future. We're going to feature panels, discussions, debates, and breakout sessions with featured guests like former Congressman Justin Amash, Tuttle Twins author Connor Boyack, Whole Foods founder John Mackey, economist Deidre McCloskey and Brian Kaplan, independent journalist Ford Fisher, and many more incredible people. You'll hear from organizations such as Fee, Reason Magazine, and my organization, You Are the Power. We've even got a special secret guest speaker. Who is it? Well, there's only one way to find out. Join me at LibertyCon. Register right now at LibertyCon.com and be sure to use the promo code ROUNDTABLE to save 25% off your registration. And I'll see you at LibertyCon.
Okay, remind her your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Matt Stevens, who writes, I was listening to Glenn Beck talk about the last Republican primary debate. That is foreshadowing for what we're going to talk about after this letter. He said, I think these are the best candidates we've had in years. My first thought was, what the hell are you talking about? Then I realized we will keep going back and forth between Democrats and Republicans who have no philosophical grounding and really don't understand freedom. So the next logical question is there any place we, and then he puts in parentheses with a capital L, libertarians, can go and start our own country or city state? Perhaps we could build a U.S. version of Hong Kong prior to 2020, on the Mexican border. Thanks. Love the show. Thank you, Matt Stevens. Catherine, this has come up a time or two over the history of Reason Magazine.
Yeah, I applaud the spirit of this question tremendously. This is the right approach. It's like, we got to go. We got to leave. We can't keep doing this.
National divorcing on us here, Catherine?
It's not. I'm just walking away. I'm just the one who walks away from politics. No, I think, yes, there have been many efforts to do this, and it turns out it's a lot harder than it looks. So, of course, we have our Free State Project, if our letter writer wants to look into that, where folks went to New Hampshire to try and kind of semi-take over, semi-do their own thing. Mixed results there. We've got your various seasteaders. We've got your various charter citiesers. You've got your Lieberlands. We've got that floating oil platform thing. There are always cool experiments in what I think could perhaps be just termed the like fuck this shit cluster of political theory, and I love that place. I don't think we've figured out the formula there. I think there's a lot of promise in the charter city model, that there is still hope that we can kind of find this correct mix between, all right, listen, we're gonna have to exist within a nation state, but could we like minimize the impact of that basic fact? And that is the kind of Hong Kong model. But Hong Kong, as you know, has fallen prey once again to one of the shittiest nation states out there, China. So, you know, I think we're looking mostly for opportunities to carve out temporary pockets of freedom that we can live in and hopefully pass on at least one generation. Nobody on the debate stage is even thinking about that. So I don't know what to do.
Nick, you're a fan of Jack Kemp. What say you?
You know that broken down old quarterback, Matt? Jack Kemp.
That's right.
Yeah. I think the bloom is off the rose of startup cities and charter cities and island paradises that end in gun and sword play before they even, you know, get to their constitutional convention.
That made it sound a little bit cooler than it actually is. Like, there's not enough swordplay. I will just briefly interject to say I was neglectful to not mention space is another option.
Yeah, that'll work out well. You know, because people
poking
each other's spacesuits with needles in zero gravity. It's not going to end well.
Really want a sword fight? Okay.
The problem is that, you know, and this is alluded to at the end of The Great Gatsby, you know, that the Dutch sailors sailing into Long Island Sound, you know, realize that they've brought the shit of the old world with them to the new world. And it's just a matter of time before it catches up and fucks everything up. We're human. You know, we're not going to fix our human problems of politics by projecting ourselves out into a virgin territory. You're more likely to end up with the People's Temple murder-suicide with off-brand, fruit punch drinks than anything else. What we need to do is, like, we need to do the work here in the places that we actually live and make them better, moving in the right direction and things like that. So, that's my sense.
Peter, what say you?
So Catherine said that no one on the debate stage was thinking about any of this, but I read the question and it talked about going to the border of Mexico. And I do think a lot of them on the debate stage were thinking about the lawless zones along the border that are run by private organizations outside of traditional, you know, large government control. And they wanted to bomb the hell out of those places. And in fact,
those bombs have fertilizer in them, the fertilizer of freedom.
I'm joking a little bit, but I do in fact think that any place that was successful enough as a country would open itself up to militarized action, right? Like, it would inevitably have, it would almost certainly, I should say, have probably drug movement and a lot of cash moving through it, because it would be a place, right, like a libertarian place like we want. Like, you'd be able to move your money around. You'd be able to buy and sell drugs. That would be a thing that, like, all four of us would be like, yep, if we're going to have our new free city zone on the border.
Haven't you just described Florida?
Yeah, right. So that's the other answer, is you can just go to Florida. But this is that sort of place, if it is successful, is going to attract attention from other governments with big militaries. And that's a problem for this. So I think Nick is right. You got to do the work here. And I also think Catherine is right. The place that you need to go is space. And in particular, you need to go to Mars. For this sort of thing to really work, you need a separated frontier. And that's what made America possible in many ways. And that is why the best place to build a new system and a new world and a new way of living is a totally different place that is physically, emotionally, and, you know, separated from today's governments and today's, you know, and the world we live in now.
And unavailable.
Yes, currently.
Yeah, that's one of his greatest talking points. Matt, are you going to go underwater, please? Are you pushing for the underwater kingdoms?
I ain't going nowhere. No, I associate myself mostly with Nick on this point. Just would add that a place that is defined by people sharing a certain political consciousness and having that close to front and center of their self-identification terrifies me. However, and I say that as someone who's enjoyed every time I've been to the Free State Project and elsewhere, and I'm happy for other people to engage in their own experiments in living. But my experiment in living wants politics to be not on the front burner, because I think that's weird. That's why I don't live in Washington, D.C., for example, because I'd rather people talk about sports.
Do you feel like you have that in New York City, though, Matt? Because it seems to me people here are highly politicized.
Yeah, and politicized about national stuff to the detriment of local stuff for the most part, and it's bad, and it creates awful governance too. So it's not that there isn't a problem being discussed. My solution, which I'm just coming up with as we speak, so it's going to be great, is that the cruise ship companies that are would be based in Florida if there wasn't for the Jones Act, but who do a lot of business in Florida, they should do like one of those Eurail passes, except that you do a cruise ship pass. So you can live on cruise ships 365 days out of the year in international water and do whatever the hell you like.
There was, in fact, a one-year kind of round-the-world cruise that was being sold right in the aftermath of COVID.
Oh, I thought I was going to say there was a Micronation on a cruise ship. That was another. There was like an experiment with that as well.
But it was cruise ship.
It was also the Kiss cruise ship at the same time. So it's like you could be free,
so it was awesome.
But you had to listen to Kiss 24/7.
I just.
What was the name of the midget Kiss band?
Mini Kiss.
Nick? Mini Kiss. Yeah.
If the cruise ship,
I would
is
go on the
Mini
Kiss cruise 365. Oh, yeah. But
everything's so cramped, Matt. It's too small. It's a robot.
Let's go on while we still have time to go on about it. We had been discussing earlier the fallout of what happened last Tuesday, but last Wednesday, the next day, was the fourth GOP presidential primary debate in a row to not feature the runaway frontrunner, Donald Trump. There were just four candidates on stage, which gave Chris Christie much more space to, that's, I didn't mean it that way, but I guess that works, yeah. to yell at Vivek Ramaswamy. The candidates talked about Israel Hamas, about bombing the fentanyl smugglers on the Mexican border, about campus anti-Semitism and free speech, about Red China, and a little bit about Trump. And also, of course, the intersection of public policy and trans kids. To give a little context before we talk about this, Trump is up nearly 50 percentage points over his nearest competitor in nationwide polls, and more like 30 and a bit lower in the early states of Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. Catherine, what did we learn at the debate?
I think we learned that none of those people are probably going to be president, and if they are, it won't be because of how they performed on that debate stage, right? So, and it felt that way. Like, watching the debate, it lacked some of the fun of previous debates, in which there is a sense like, we are meeting these people, we are getting to know them, and one of them is going to be the president, maybe. Like, realistically, that feeling was lacking. Everyone's performance reflected the lack of that feeling, and it was kind of a bummer.
Peter, is there any takeaway that you had about the state of Republican policymaking out of this? Oh, no.
Oh, no. That's it. It's just laughter. No, Catherine's right. Like, as I thought of Alex Baldwin and Glengarry Glenn Ross as I was watching this, right? It's like the second, they're competing for second place, and the prize for second place is a set of steak knives, and third prize is you're fired. And that's what it felt like.
Did you just call
like.
Him Alex Baldwin?
Did I say Alex Baldwin? Whatever, Alec Baldwin. Right. And, you know, I think in terms of the people, no one did particularly well for themselves. Haley probably ended up doing the best, but she's going to win the Never Trump primary because she offered a clearer rationale for voting for her than over Trump than DeSantis did. But that's not a victory. You don't get anything for that.
Nick, broad takeaway from the thing?
Yeah, I just want to pipe in as a big supporter of Chris Christie appearing in all of these debates. And even if he is remanded to being like the sign language person in the corner, but he has no chance of winning. He has no chance of being the candidate or anything, but he brings the fat fuck New Jersey energy. That is kind of great on that stage because he told Vivek Ramaswamy, like, shut the fuck up. And then Vivek made a fat joke, you know, on the way out, like, go home and get a meal.
A bad one,
yeah,
not even a
you just did.
But that's what's kind of good. He reveals like Vivek is not even good at insults, right? You know, even as he had like a bunch of bits worked out. But what's good about Chris Christie is that he's calling out the Republican Party for being Trumpy. You know, and ginger about him because after the debate as well, he was talking about how Nikki Haley is she's the only person who plausibly at this point seems within reach of beating Donald Trump. And she won't really go after him. And he's like, what the hell is wrong with you? You know, and then to the extent that Vivek is kind of mimicking Trump, he's calling that out. Ron DeSantis, it's fascinating because, you know, he's the most successful current politician on that stage. And he just keeps turning, like, you know, more and more opaque. Like, nobody, he's done, maybe comes back in, you know, 4 years or 8 years or something like that. But I actually came away from that really relishing Chris Christie's presence. And I do not like Chris Christie. But, you know, he is the emetic, you know, he's the syrup of Ipecac that needs to be on that stage if the Republican Party is going to do something other than nominate Trump and then, you know, kind of stick close to him because he might win and then say like, oh, you know, he hijacked us. He screwed us over. Like, he's Jiminy Cricket in this, despite being 600 pounds.
I had a similar reaction to Christie, minus any at all fondness for anything coming out of New Jersey, which was that he has zero path to the nomination. You can't win doing what he's doing right now. There's just no way. And he didn't get a poll bump. And I kind of resent how the media and how us even, because he said some pretty good things on stage, actually, unusually for him, tend to like him and kind of root for him. And I think it's a like he's going to get in the way of having an actual one-on-one fight between someone and Trump. That's what I thought going in. And then coming out, and I had the very similar feeling of Nick, like that's a valuable service that he's providing up there as he's pulling down 3% of the vote, although he is doing pretty well in New Hampshire, like for someone who's not polling well. Christie's, all right, we've done Christie, but Catherine, I'm going to step on Suderman right now. Because Nick name-checked Nikki Haley. You're a lady. How did you think that Nikki did? She got white-knighted by Chris Christie there for a little bit.
She did. And she was wearing that nice white dress with the mother of bride rhinestones, which we're not supposed to talk about their clothes, but anyway.
Why not?
Because it's shallow and shitty. Okay, so the thing about Nikki Haley is that I had said some nice things about her at previous debates and on this podcast. She really rolled up, like her first answer was just like, Catherine, stop saying nice things about me. Like I felt like she was making eye contact with me through the television to teach me a lesson, and I consider the lesson learned. She's not a libertarian. She was never a libertarian. I said over and over, she's not a libertarian. But wow, that debate was a reminder that she is not a libertarian. I still do appreciate that her platform, I guess, like the thing that she is more or less running on was like, you know, no whining, no, like, let's just, no drama, no vendettas, no whining. That is a thing that she explicitly promised. I appreciate that, but it is probably too little too late. And a bunch of her answers were just like, I would do a deeply authoritarian thing that would make the world and this country worse if I were president. So thanks for the reminder,
Catherine,
Nikki.
Don't you realize that TikTok is making everybody 17% stupider every 30 minutes?
Right. The TikTok answers have always been among many bad answers, her worst answers. Meanwhile, and also just her stuff on the trans issues is like the muddiest of the answers. Chris Christie's trans answer was so good, but he's not my assigned candidate.
Yes. Peter, your assigned candidate, being from Florida, is the guy who I thought won the transcript debate. But then you had to look
the
at
coveted,
it.
The coveted transcript debate.
The coveted
winner,
transcript debate. What did you, what was your take on
Mr. Smiles,
the humanoid Ron DeSantis?
Yeah. In some ways, my answer goes back to Nick's, because the thing about DeSantis is that he kept losing to Chris Christie. And every single time there was a clash between the two of them, Christie totally owned DeSantis on parental rights, on Trump's fitness for office. Christie was just able to turn DeSantis into a sputtering sort of robotic mess. And by speaking clearly,
there's a new sheriff in town, Peter.
Yes.
I don't know if you heard.
Yeah, I loved it when Eddie Murphy said that. But by speaking right, like the thing that Christie is able to do because he's not going to win is that he can speak clearly from the heart with like moral resolve. And what every single one of those encounters or back and forths between the two of them, frankly, just about every DeSantis answer, even discarding the ones where he went back and forth with Christie, what they always revealed was that DeSantis, unlike Christie, doesn't speak plainly and from the heart. He is a fairly obvious political calculation machine, right? And it's, you know, the again, to go back to Glengarry Glenn Ross here, right? The monologue is always be closing, but DeSantis can't close. And for him, it's like ABP, always be positioning. And that was his entire debate.
Bad. name that, is he did
get,
like?
Did you get DeSantis's speechwriter? Something. Yeah.
Is he like Alan Arkin?
The new sheriff in town. It's Peter Subin.
Like what character? If he is not Alec Baldwin, which character is he? Is he Shelley the Machine? Jack, like, let's go with Glengarry Glen Ross.
Jack Lemmon. I will take Vivek Ramaswamy for 400, Alex. And my comment about him is going to be just to read a quote from the aforementioned transcript. I'm going to do it at probably one-third speed of Vivek. Why am I the only person on the stage, at least, who can say that January 6th now does look like it was an inside job? That the government lied to us for 20 years about Saudi Arabia's involvement in 9/11? That the Great Replacement Theory is not some grand right-wing conspiracy theory, but a basic statement of the Democratic Party's platform? That the 2020 election was indeed stolen by big tech? That the 2016 election, the one that Trump won for sure, was also one that was stolen from him by the national security establishment that actually put out the Trump-Russia collusion hoax that they knew was false?
Can we put this on the younger people on the podcast? Like, explain Vivek Ramaswamy. He's your generation. You guys have ownership of him.
All I did is, like, 5 minutes after he said those words, the Libertarian Party was like, ooh,
yeah. We have found our candidate. Move over, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And with Sirhan as your running mate, now we're going with Vivek.
He has been name checking Ron Paul a whole lot and talking up Bitcoin even more. And
Elon Musk, he has a really bad case of Twitter brain.
I think that my prediction is that for the next debate, Vivek is actually going to appear in drag and then make some kind of reversal. Like, that'll be some kind of big point.
Oh, that's
he's going to be wearing high heels and then take them off and throw them at Nikki Haley and say, like, you know what, I can do what you do in heels, but I don't have to. Something
and
like
then
that.
After and the then debate
break out into a 17 minute Bollywood
Ron DeSantis will just be seen tucking them into his bag.
All right, this is off the rails enough, so let's go to our end of a podcast, what we all have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
Yes, I have returned to one of my favoritest podcasts of all time, which is Hardcore History with Dan Carlin. There's a new free episode that came out a couple weeks ago. It's about Vikings. It's the second in a series. The first episode was 5 hours long. And it wasn't enough. So Twilight of the Aesir, it's a good podcast. And I recognize that there are Dan Carlin haters out there, including, get ready for a really douchey story. When I was speaking at the TED, when I gave my TED talk, I got made fun
of. Was that when Matt was working
stage
in Czechoslovakia?
It was. I'm going to start making this my thing.
And I was co-authoring the Declaration of Independence?
When I got made fun of on stage for an offstage conversation with a comedian in which he asked people what they did for fun, and I said, listen to this podcast. So I recognize it's ridiculous, but it's also very, very good. And if you, like me, had a kind of shitty public school education and didn't learn any history, this is a much better way to do that and make up some deficits. Vikings. More than meets the eye. Dan Carlin, Hardcore History.
You're telling me in Virginia in the late 90s, you didn't do deep dives into Viking history?
Surprising,
truly,
isn't it?
Truly an educational wasteland.
Yeah. Yeah. We had all of fourth grade was Black History Month, Nick. We were busy. Yeah.
Okay.
My entirety of my Viking education was from a heavy metal band in my college days that was called Mons Pubis, that had a song called Viking Sun, and I might just play it if we.
Well, the Immigrant Song is a great intro to all things.
That has just brought together my two podcast obsessions, since that's probably also one
I
of
can't
the 60
believe
songs
anybody
that explains the 90s.
Actively dislikes Dan Carlin though, because like. It might not be your cup of tea, but it's so fucking good.
There are haters.
Nick, besides Dan Carlin, what have you
Okay, so I read a fantastic novel by Lexi Freeman called The Book of Ein, and it's about a writer who is like a wealthy Manhattanite, MFA recipient, who writes a book that is it's happened as the novel takes place, but she wrote a book, a comic novel of opioid addiction in Appalachia, and gets canceled for being culturally appropriating as well as indifferent to the suffering of hillbillies. And then she ends up in, she like stumbles across a walking tour of Ayn Rand's New York and then kind of becomes obsessed with Ayn Rand. And then it just becomes this incredibly great parody of everything about the current moment in terms of publishing, in terms of social media. There's great, a great like two paragraph interaction with people who are obviously the Red Scare girls. And then it ends on the Isle of Lesbos. Ayn Rand is built through all of this. It is so funny and deep, and it reminds me of Nathaniel West. If people know his work, The Day of the Locust, Cool Million, Miss Lonely Hearts, one of the most scathing satirists who never let a joke go because, you know, he wasn't, she like him is not the type of person who, you know, you catch the mouse, the cat catches the mouse and then plays with it and lets it go. No, like they make sure to kill it in front of you. And it's very fun and mean and nasty. And the only thing I can say bad about the Book of Ayn is that Lexi Freeman is originally from Australia. That's like my one complaint. It should have been written by an American, but it is a great, great fucking funny book that is, you know, about social media, about publishing, about wokeness, about sexual politics, about Central Europe. It's an incredible book. And I don't know if Objectivists, maybe Catherine, you can let me know. I don't know if Objectivists celebrate Christmas or Saturnalia or something, but like this would be a great year-end gift for anybody who loves Ayn Rand, because it's both mocking her, but on another level, it's the latest iteration of her continuing ability to inject herself into contemporary American popular culture.
I appreciate your attempt to get my attention with that Central Europe, Nick.
I'm not saying it for you, Matt. I'm saying it for the little people out there.
Minikiss.
Yeah, the Minikiss. The Minikiss members in Slovenia and in the future, what I like to call the future Yugoslavia.
Yeah, that's good, Peter. What do you consider?
Speaking of little people, I saw Godzilla Minus One. It's the new Godzilla movie from Toho, which is the Japanese company that has been making Godzilla movies for forever. It's in Japanese, and it totally rules. It is set in the years just after World War II, as Godzilla attacks Japan, has gotten much bigger thanks to American nuclear tests. And this movie is Spielbergian in the best possible way. The whole third act is basically a plan to do a reverse Jaws on Godzilla. They're instead of bringing Jaws, the big monster, to the surface of the water using oxygen tanks, they're going to use some special tanks that they wrap around him, filled with some stuff that will sink Godzilla, right? And they want to sink him to the bottom of the sea into a big trench. But it is also a movie about how when a big crisis comes, government won't save you. And that's true even when the crisis was caused by or exacerbated by government. And so the plot is basically that Godzilla attacks. And then for political reasons, the Japanese government, which has been disarmed, can't and won't step in to save the country. And the U.S. government doesn't want to send in the military because it's worried about inflaming tensions with the Soviet Union. So the survivors of the war in Japan organize a coalition of private citizens, and they're constantly talking about how this has to be a private effort, that the government's not gonna help us. There's a whole long monologue that's just kind of incredible about how the Japanese government already failed the Japanese citizens so much, put them through so much with the war, just botched all the supply lines, just was kind of abusive and callous and incompetent. But even still, all of these survivors of the war have to be the ones to band together to stop Godzilla, because there's no one else, because they're the people who live there, and they're the people who will bear the brunt of the Godzilla consequences if Godzilla is allowed to stomp all over them again. So they get a bunch of boats together, and they try to sink Godzilla into a deep trench and crush him with the power of the ocean. And it's freaking awesome. And if you like big monster movies and you hate government, strongly recommend it.
What does the minus one refer to? Godzilla Minus One, right?
I'm not actually sure I know that. It might be that it's like the numbering scheme or Godzilla, right? Because it's sort of a reboot of the franchise in that it takes place just a couple of years after World War II again and re-presents Godzilla as a kind of national but also individual psychic trauma.
The original Godzilla is episode 4.
I love Godzilla 85, which was a remake with Raymond Burr. I was going to say Aaron Burr, which would have been even better, but Raymond Burr walking. And it's almost like he's in the Ironside wheelchair, Matt, but like Raymond Burr, who was in the original Godzilla and is just kind of making soliloquies on the beach like, what's his face? The
Charles
the, No, the Alaska Senator, Mike Gravel did. In some of those ads, yeah, it's like wow. It's. But Peter, my son saw Godzilla Minus One, and he was saying what was interesting. He watches a lot of anime and stuff. Is that this might be one of the first movies too, where the Japanese, like within the context of the movie, are critiquing the imperial government for all of the awful things it did, which is really kind of fascinating because Japan has not really, you know, dealt with that.
The main character was somebody who was assigned to a kamikaze squad as a fighter pilot and pretended that his airplane was broken, and so he couldn't do the kamikaze and had to turn around and go to a repair island where at the mini Godzilla, not mini Kiss, attacks in the opening sequence, which is also great. It's the best basically adaptation of the T-Rex attack from the middle of Jurassic Park, except with Godzilla. It's just so perfectly done. And what's also just incredible about this movie is it was made for $15 million and it looks nearly as good and often better as the recent Godzilla movies that have come out that have been $150, $200 million budgets. Much better, I think, frankly, than the Godzilla TV show that is currently airing on, I think, Apple Plus. Just really well done and kind of rousing and like a very effective popular movie, except done for a $15 million budget in a foreign language.
All right. Consumption was the two-part PBS series by Ken Burns called The American Buffalo. Came out in October, and it's my favorite thing that Ken Burns has ever done. I haven't watched everything that he's done, but usually they're always well done, but there's usually like, come on. Usually whenever he's trying to sort of like shoehorn whatever topic that he's discussing in whatever kind of contemporary metaphorical frame, that's when things go wrong. Didn't feel like that happening here at all. It's a quick, taut tale about how the bison, the American buffalo, which roamed the plains and the prairies in the millions, I think even tens of millions for a long time, then were basically hunted down to near extinction in a matter of a few decades of the 19th century. And the story is shocking, actually, the amount of carnage. It's a critique of industrial capitalism, yes, but also it is twinned at every step, as it must be, with the way that the federal government dealt with Native Americans. And oftentimes used it very explicitly, like, yes, if we kill the buffalo, it would be bad because it's a great, wonderful American animal, but it allows us to solve the Indian problem because Indians, especially in all of the plains states, had been the buffalo was just central to their everything, every kind of meats and good and clothing and hide and whatever, and therefore religion. And what makes this so great, it's a story about sort of the kill off and then the restocking of the buffalo herds afterwards. And some of the same characters who did the killing ended up playing central roles in the restocking, the Teddy Roosevelts of the world. So it ends on a little bit of uplift. But what I liked about it the best, besides just learning stuff and its kind of skill in doing it, was it just feels like part of what feels like a pretty recent trend of positing Native Americans as just being Americans. There are many who are quoted from that. It's not like dealt with some exotica as they would be treated like in the 1970s or some kind of sort of special extra mysticism that we should really learn from everything that they've ever said. It's just kind of matter of fact and therefore all the more devastating and just infuriating about how they were treated. It's part and parcel to me of shows like Reservation Dogs, of Killers of the Flower Moon, of Fancy Dance, another Lily Gladstone movie that I talked about a few weeks back. And it's just kind of great and uplifting and absolutely like infuriating. It's really difficult to watch how awful government policy, how like abjectly murderous government policy was toward people for a really long time. It should awaken some of those feelings. But in the meantime, you'll just learn stuff and it's beautiful and it's America and whatnot. And it's done very well. Ken Burns, American Buffalo. Check it out. You'll be glad you did, etc. All right. That's all the time that we have for this business here. Before we step out, I want to rehype what Catherine talked about earlier in the show, which is the rebranded show, Just Asking Questions. Liz Wolf and Zach Weiss, Mueller. Have been doing. The first one came out just this past week, I believe, with the libertarian comic and podcaster Dave Smith asking, what is a libertarian? should get Matt Walsh on there next for the next show. But anyway, so that's new. It's great. You can subscribe to it. Go on YouTube. It's on the Apple, Spotify, SoundCloud, you know, places. But go and check it out. They're doing the Lord's work. And we have a whole bunch of new stuff coming down the pike, as Catherine was also alluding to. Nick, is there stuff in New York that you would like to
Yeah, tomorrow on Tuesday, December 12th, we're going to be having a great event with Jennifer Burns, the biographer of Milton Friedman, who wrote a fantastic definitive book about his life and times called The Last Conservative. That's happening at the Blue Building in Midtown Manhattan. If you go to reason.com/events, you can get information and buy tickets. Beer, wine, soda, food, and camaraderie and conversation in a really great setting in Midtown.
Awesome. Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you up next week. Goodbye. What's your